This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
And what's Twilight?
What is your favorite monster type?
I can imagine Jeff Bezos sitting on his pile of gold.
Mind flayers aren't scary anymore. Beholders aren't scary anymore.
Monsters of Drakenheim is coming to Kickstarter. It launches March 26th.
I love all of my mutant children.
I'm the one who's like, yeah, my favorite kid's this one.
Chris Cox has been quoted. Maybe AI is cool, actually.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And I gotta say, I'm still against it.
There is no such thing as politically neutral technology.
I like the idea of AI being used as a tool for things like, I wish AI was doing my taxes.
The Daggerheart playtest material.
Can I do a YouTube face at it? Can I be like,
it might be bad for the more shy players.
The yes, but the no and are my favorites.
Here's its druid class. You can see it right there on the card.
All that and more right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one dice picnic podcast in all the realms. That's right. When you want a dice picnic with rules and characters and story unfolding at the table or on your picnic mat, you come to this podcast. My name is Ben Byrne, joined by James Hake, and this week, very excited to have Monty Martin and Kelly McLaughlin from the Dungeon Dudes. What is your favorite monster type and why?
I think it's pretty clear that aberrations are the favorite creature type. I don't think you're going to get a different answer from Kelly on this one.
What is it about like the thing that tickles that part of the back of your brain that makes you be like, okay, this is interesting. This speaks to me.
I think for me, it's about creatures that are beyond human comprehension on a deep, like psychological level. Things that by their mere existence prompt us to question what we know about reality itself and strike the fear that the stability, the logic, the reason that we rely on to understand our world, that these creatures defy it by their mere existence. The confrontation with a living, breathing thing that says reality is unknowable. And if you thought the laws of physics were a thing, you're wrong. And I think that what I love about aberrations is that they prompt us to question what we think we know about the order of the universe and whether or not the idea of a cosmic order is even a coherent concept.
Kelly, is Monty correct? Is that your answer as well?
He is. For the sake of being different, I will say that the other one that I'm very passionate about is undead. And that comes from a childhood love of like, for some reason, this is going to date me a lot, but when I was a young child, my dad showed me Jason and the Argonauts. And there's the scene where with the clay animation skeletons. And I was obsessed with that scene as a kid. I watched just that one. I would go back and watch it over and over again. Then I got into Warhammer and immediately I was like, I don't want to play knights and whatever. That's silly stuff. And then somebody showed me the book and I saw the undead army and was like, I'm in. And like from a very young age, I was just fascinated by like that creepy darkness of like the classic like skeleton warrior style, like mummies and zombies and all of that. So although Monty is correct, like aberrations, my favorite type of horror is cosmic horror and that sort of thing, which aberrations really dive into. But I'm also a big fan of like classic horror with vampires, skeletons, zombies and mummies. Those sorts of things are just super fascinating. And like where aberrations bring you into the world of unfathomable horror, which I love, there's something about undead that bring you into the completely fathomable horror and almost the most realistic sense of horror is death. And to me, playing with the idea of undeath is a very core fear that a lot of humans can gravitate towards.
My answer to this question would be undead because I, you know, vampires, ghosts, you know, I love, particularly because they innately come with stories, you know, like a ghost comes, how did this thing die? Why are they still here? But I have a theory that part of the reason why ghost stories in particular are so popular isn't just because the ghost is creepy, but it also kind of gives a sense of hope that there is more after death, you know, that if this ghost exists, then surely the soul survives in some form.
Mind flayers and dragons are my like classic
favorites. They're iconic for a reason. They're big. They capture the imagination. They're flexible. But right now, I'm very torn as a storyteller between two kind of opposite poles of what I want monsters to be able to do. Because typically what I like for monsters is I like them to be representational. I like them to be representations of human failings. I love it when, say, goblins and orcs are not necessarily their own species, but an almost fairy tale like representation of human greed and cowardice and human aggression, right? Right. For example, people who begin to embody these vices have this sort of like spiritual power that takes over them. Let's say that. Dragons fill that role really well. I can imagine Jeff Bezos sitting on his pile of gold in a Mercer Island mansion here in Seattle, for example. But on the other hand, I've been so captured by Delicious in Dungeon, the hit anime on Netflix, that I've gone and read.
Ooh, I'm glad you brought that up.
I've picked up all the comic books that I can get on my hand, all the manga I can get my hands on. And that series does an incredible job of creating highly detailed ecologies for the system that they live in, not just for the monsters, but for like the adventurer's ecology of the town, the economy and ecology of that. Those two things, they don't necessarily play very well together, the representational monster and the sort of like bestialized monster. Two great tastes that I don't think taste great together.
Monster ecologies are fascinating. But for me, part of what I love about aberrations is they simply defy that level of understanding, mm-hmm. right? For me, I both love and also kind of philosophically don't love, say, the presentation of the Mind Flayer chapter in Volo's Guide to Monsters. Because for me, that is more than we should ever know about these creatures, right? Mm-hmm. That is presented, that makes them too knowable. And once we know something that well, it's not scary anymore.
It's right? the wrong and, approach for that yeah, kind of story, yeah. right?
And absolutely, Mind Flayers aren't scary anymore. Beholders aren't scary anymore because there's too much has been written about them. I love characters like Xanathar, but the character of Xanathar, as soon as you can have that exist, that is no longer an alien unknown entity. That is now just another human with a funny face. You know, Drakenheim was a place where I wanted monsters to be monsters. One of the things that I like to say with the world of Drakenheim is that Drakenheim has an anti-cosmology. It has a cosmology that very, very explicitly is not something that the mortal inhabitants of the world of Drakenheim will ever be able to understand or comprehend. Precisely because I want a world where, even though we're writing a big book of monsters about what all is known about them, I think what we're trying to do with Monsters of Drakenheim is very much focused on like, this is what people think they know, but not that kind of omniscient viewpoint that impassively can tell you everything about this monster because the people that live in the world don't necessarily know those things.
That economy, that intentional withholding of information is often what makes this kind of genre fiction so compelling. But if you're entrusting a lot of the creativity to a game master, you know, where to draw the line between sharing and withholding.
If you solve that problem, let me know.
I think it's hard because like DMs want enough information to be able to create their own narratives. Like Monty and I wrote a monster that I want to use. I want to run like an arc that is 1980s The Blob movie based on one of the monsters we created. But in order to do that, I need to explain to a DM, like in order for somebody else to be able to do that, I need to explain to a DM what this monster is, where it comes from, why it works this way, enough that they could also be inspired to be like, I can now use this to not tell my players, but to imply a narrative. And it's riding that line of, I find myself in writing the new book, I'm using in the lore the words legends suggest or rumors of this monster say a lot, because it's kind of the depiction of what humans have interacted with this monster, and those who have researched it, here's what they think is going on. But some of the areas, Monty and I actually just had a talk recently about the book, and we were discussing, I wanted to write a section on the fairy otherworlds in our setting and some of the monsters there, which is essentially the fae. But Monty was like, the only way that we should write this is by implying that nobody knows what the heck's going on with it. And I was like, that's fair, because otherwise we're giving people a lot of something that Monty and I aren't ready to define. We want these things to be mysterious. So it is actually cool to say, well, here's a section of the book that is defined by its unknown.
I actually think the advantage that we have in tabletop role-playing games is when you make that stuff mysterious, it gives the GMs room to invent and make decisions for themselves and what they like about a setting and what they think. Like, if they want to make it all concrete in their game, they can do that, or they can lean into the mysteriousness that you're trying to suggest.
Yes, and that's why I think for myself in writing our current crop of monsters, the question that I like to explore is, what is the layer of interface? Like, what is the point? In a certain way, like, just as our phones are kind of these magical black boxes, like, we don't really know what's actually happening inside that thing. But I know that I can touch the glowing screen and I can listen to the fun sounds. And so, to a certain extent, the emphasis of in communicating a monster entry, the game statistics for sure actually do a lot of heavy lifting, especially when you present them in an interesting way. But I also think that you know, one of the things that we like to do is write that very evocative physical description that goes alongside the artwork, because art is such a huge thing in tabletop role-playing games books, especially for fifth edition worlds of things. And an art tells you a lot about how a monster looks, but it doesn't necessarily tell you how it moves, what it smells like, how it sounds, what it feels like to be around it, what its presence feels like. And so those are things that the spoken word part of our medium, because I think a role-playing game is fundamentally a spoken word medium. It's a medium that shares a lineage from the campfire storytelling that of, you know, whether you've been around a campfire and told stories, or, you know, from ancient storytellings all the way today. I think that level of communication of where the role-playing game lives means that we giving the thick description and giving a description as well, using that quality of the spoken word and that can imply as much as you can and set off the things in the player's mind. Because a player's mind is always going to imagine, it's going to be more powerful than any sort of actual visual aid. Although visual aids can help set that off, right? Mm-hmm. Just the sparks of, like, what are the sensory bits of information that you need to activate the imagination in whatever form that it works? Because also everyone's brains work differently. And so people often need a different combination of prompts to get that engagement happening. And so for me at writing, it's like, okay, how do I give the dungeon master, the game master, as many prompts that they can use, that they can take to give to their players as well? That's one place to begin.
Well, speaking of monsters and Drakenheim, Monsters of Drakenheim is coming to Kickstarter. It launches March 26th. So I think we're only 2 weeks out at this point.
One week.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. We are close. You're absolutely right. The book, just the you know, 150 plus new monsters spanning CR from 1 to 30. But it's more than just a monster book, to my understanding. It's got lore, obviously, for each monster, but some of the boss monsters have lairs, so that, you know, you're not just getting a stat block, but you're getting an entire encounter to create adventures with. There's a harvest and crafting system in there. There's deadly conditions, which I'm curious to mine down into if you're able to talk about it. Do you have a favorite monster from the book?
I love all of my mutant children.
Oh, man. My answer, I'm the one who's like, yeah, my favorite kid's this one. So, okay, here's the thing. I have a favorite monster, but it's kind of a secret. Monty and I, one day in the studio, decided that one of the figures rumored in the lore of Drakenheim as a bit of a historical figure, a bit of like a legend, we decided that maybe it had a place in the book as an epic monster. And while Monty and I were deciding what that epic monster might look like, we started discussing the lore. We started to discuss what form it might take. And as that sort of all occurred, we ended up with a monster that spans three stat blocks as three different forms. We were taking vibes from some of our favorite things there, but like it has, it's like weakened form, it's like middle form, and then it's I'm a giant monster form. You think this is my final form sort of boss.
Yes. Yeah.
And as we dug into the lore and actually started designing what this character might be doing, it became the lore attached to it and the implications for the setting of Drakenheim. I was just like, well, I'm in love. So that is my favorite. But because I can't announce what it is, separate from the one that I'm talking about, there is a chapter that Monty and I have been working on, which is our Apothecary Abominations.
Yeah.
Which, In our second book, we made a brand new class called the Apothecary.
I see where this is going. I like it.
They're very like mad scientists, like classic science fiction, like science fiction fantasy.
Very Victor Frankenstein
inspired.
But we also started in designing the monsters, we were like drawing a lot on BioShock as well. Was a big influence for a lot of these monsters.
A lot of classic horror as well.
We recently have done a couple playtest games and we've got our upcoming live play series. And for me, running these monsters in our Monster Hunt games that are going to be airing during the Kickstarter, they're fun to run. And I think people have seen the cinematic trailer now, and they've probably seen the big monster with the giant bone saw in the artwork, and that is the Ripper. Yeah. And in one of our playtest games, that monster, which is challenge rating 15, did 180 points of damage in a single round, and it just felt amazing. to see that happen. It was a stars aligned situation. Cause it happened to be a situation where that monster could only miss with an attack on one, on a natural one. And so I won't spoil exactly how it went down. It was definitely like, this is the only circumstance where this would ever happen. But it was amazing. And it was like, yeah. I'm so glad this is the thing.
Just so that people aren't like horrified by this, I will say that the Ripper has a very specific shtick. It is terrifying. Like it is a terrifying monster, but its thing that it does is terrifying in specific situations for specific characters. And we somehow accidentally formulated the perfect situation for this monster to do what it does best at optimal levels. And because of the way the situation played out, and you'll have to wait until you watch the episode of our actual play, it actually wasn't horrifying. It was horrifying to see, but everybody was okay.
We
did all right. It wasn't as it sounds way more brutal than it is. And at the table, it's meant to make players feel like, oh my God, it can do that.
The Ripper's cool feature is that it keeps attacking till it misses. That's a giant spinning saw blade. It doesn't stop until it misses. And so if you put a
mechanic like that into Tel Dorei Reborn ages ago. I love that mechanic.
Yeah, I remember the stabby stabber, James. I remember the stabby stabber.
Its second feature is that it automatically crits anyone who is frightened.
Gotcha.
And of course, it has a frightening mechanic as well.
It really will go through you. And we're very explicit in the stats that it does not stop attacking when it reduces someone to zero hit points.
So polymorph was a bad spell choice.
And we'll
leave it at that. We'll leave it at that. Watch the show. Yeah. It's fun.
One of my fun bits of lore that the Apothecary Abominations have in their section is, of course, the Apothecary Abominations are explicitly made by unfortunate victims. And some of them have their memories still in there. And so we have a table of what are the residual memories that could pacify one of these Apothecary Abominations by showing them maybe playing a song that reminds them of their own life, or showing them a trinket that reminds them of who they were, that can actually affect these creatures, because they kind of run they're in this weird liminal space between a construct and undead. And so they're a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
And that's definitely one of the darkest backdrops we have in our book for monsters.
Tell us a bit about, because I teased it before, the deadly conditions. I'm curious, this sounds like a new kind of spoke to the wheel of 5e, so to speak.
Monty and I, when we started working on this book, were both playing a ton of Tears of the Kingdom and Breath of the Wild, the Zelda games in general, and a lot like also like Diablo and a lot of these other games. You use fire arrows, you use ice arrows, you use shock arrows. And like when you get shocked, when you are on fire, when you get hit with ice, what happens to you? And the fact that D&D never had a burning, frozen, or shocked mechanic always felt weird to me. It's like, yeah, we can do fire damage, but then we have this a bunch of text that happens very rarely that's like, okay, if you get hit with the fire damage, you're set on fire. Here's how that's going to work. And we're like, why not just make a condition that's burning? What's interesting about these conditions is the way that we've mapped them out is burning is a condition that does X damage per turn, and you establish that in the stat block when you're delivering burning.
So it'll say like burning 4d6. So it will tell you, it allows us to vary how intense the flames are.
And all that means, so instead of having to write it out fully in the stat block, it just means if you are burning for 4d6, on your turn, you either have the option of taking an action to douse the flames or continue burning. And that's basically it. Frozen is a little bit more brutal. You get stuck in place. You can still move your arms. So we allow you, we imagine that you're like frozen from like the waist down. So you can still like attack and do things, but you're frozen in place. And you actually, so another condition that we established, which is more shortening text, but you become helpless to bludgeoning damage. Helpless means that an attack automatically crits you. So you're frozen, you're helpless to bludgeoning damage, but if you take 20 or more bludgeoning or fire damage, you're no longer frozen. So essentially, and we played this out and it's hilarious, this one isn't filmed, but we did a test play where Monty froze my warlock that I was playtesting with, and I had Eldritch Blast with Repelling Blast, and I thought I was so clever because the troll had his club and I was repelling blasting him, being like, ah, he's not going to crit me. And then Monty picked up a crate and threw it at me, which did bludgeoning damage and automatically crit me. But then it knocked me out of the frozen. And it was such a fun time, even for me as a player, the fear of getting the box thrown at me and then immediately getting knocked out, taking the bunch of damage, but getting back up and being free of the condition. It worked. It was a lot of fun in play. And that's what we're hoping. Mm. I set somebody on fire in a test play, and it was a paladin who had fly cast on them. And they just kept taking the damage while they flew at enemies and continued to slay them. And I was like, this is so cool to see a flaming paladin just be like, I don't care, I'll take the damage. I'm going to run into battle anyway. And it's those choices that the player has to then make that I think make our conditions really interesting.
And that was the other kind of design element, is that we knew in making a bunch of monsters that we wanted to give them a diverse array of tactical abilities that would be more interesting than just a bag of hit points. But more than just the bag of hit points problem, I think that in looking at a lot of the monsters that have been designed across the lifespan of 5th edition, you tend to see a lot of this monster grapples and restrains you, this monster pushes and pulls you, and this monster stuns you and gives you disadvantage. And so we kind of gave ourselves this rule of like, we don't want monsters that stun players or do hard incapacitation effects on them, because we actually think that players getting stunned is rarely fun. So we wanted to have conditions that imposed interesting choices where you had so burning is a choice. Are you going to spend your action to put yourself out, or are you going to accept more damage? Frozen, similarly, puts a threat of something happening on you, but you can actively get out of that situation or say, you know what, I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to stay here frozen and do the cool thing that I wanted to do anyways. So we wanted to create this kind of stable of abilities that we could give to the monsters as we were designing them, that we could pull from and use in different combinations that we knew would create interesting circumstances, give a bit of a shorthand as well. And so one of the things we're going to see as we play test and work from backers is how much we have to put into the stat blocks and where we can put something as a condition. Our layout editor, Martin Hughes, is doing this really cool thing with the monster cards for Monsters of Drakenheim, where if a monster is using one of our new conditions, he's been able to lay out some of the monster cards to actually put the full text of those conditions on the card as a reference tool. And so that's also where I'm hoping some of the virtual stuff will give us some fun things as well to work with there. So it really has all been come from a place of wanting to design monsters that have that push. You know, it used to be, again, we want more monsters that are more than bag of hit points, but we're going past that. We want monsters not only that are more than a bag of hit points, but monsters that actually do cool things that are fun to face and give players interesting choices about how they respond to the tactical challenge, rather than just being like, you know what, this monster has such a deadly ability, I just need to cast Hold Monster on it and be done with it.
Monty and Kelly, you obviously enjoy creating new mechanics for your products. Do you like it just as much as creating lore, classes, monsters?
Oddly enough, like, creating new mechanics is probably lower on the list for me. For me, it's a way to help me. When creating a product, there is a little bit of a marketing strategy behind creating new mechanics, because you can say, hey, this has new mechanics in it. It also gives, as Monty said, an avenue for us to explore things that aren't currently being explored in the game, which allow us to then expand on our own world and lore. But I mean, I'm a sucker for the lore of my world. And everything that I create is implied by that lore. This monster book, one of my favorite things about it is that every monster comes jam-packed with a pretty decent lore entry that you can use as a DM if you want. Like, it not only gives you an idea of what this monster looks, feels, and acts like, but beyond that, if you are into the world of Drakenheim, it implies where you might find it, what it's doing there, and I want everything that we create in the world of Drakenheim to expand on the world in some capacity. And our second book, which was a sort of source book for the world, it had most of the book is actually about the wider world of Drakenheim. That was one of the most daunting, but also one of my favorite things to write, because I really got to, really, it's just Monty and I get to jam about our imagination, and we'll come up with like a cool thing and be like, what if this was here? Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of play jazz music on that idea for a while. And we're doing that with the monster book as well. We're like I said, the monster that I'm not talking about because it's a big secret and maybe you'll see it. The day that Monty and I decided what the lore for that creature was such a fun day, because to me, that was Monty and I doing jazz in the studio where we were just like, what if this, what if this, what if, and like,
yeah.
Those are my favorite moments for creation. The mechanics of the thing are there to help imply the story and the lore that I'm trying to tell.
Yeah, I have, I talk about the perfect marriage between like a monster, its type, the mechanics, and the story that monster tells. And just something that I love doing, or at least I love the feeling of when you get it right, is when you have a monster, you know what its story is, and you're trying to figure out the mechanics that best tell that story and mm-hmm. what that monster can do. And you're like, okay, what if I give it this ability? No, that's going to be too strong. So, and this CR is not going to be high enough, or that's not going to be fun for the players to interact with, or this is going to be too weak and it's not really going to. And then when you find like just some elegant way of, getting exactly what that monster does thematically in a mechanic, it's that moment that I'm like, oh, I did it. Ah, oh, the puzzle piece just clicked into place. Ah, oh, this feels so good. Ah, oh, yes.
Feel the dopamine. Yes.
Yeah, it's good. Exactly. Exactly. Nobody clip that bit. James, what about yourself?
I think the dudes hit the nail on the head with this one, right? It's like, there are two very different types of creativity. There's that free form jazz to just like jamming with someone, coming up with an idea and riffing on it as much as you like until it begins to take shape. And then there's the brass tacks doing of it. And they're both great. They're both great. And when done really well, they're both effective as both game design and as narrative design tools, because they should each imply something about what the other one is, technically more capable at. That's you know, in game design, the maxim is nothing should ever only have a single purpose. Every element of your game should be doing double duty at least, because that creates elegance in your design. So, you know, it's like asking me if I like days when I can be freeform creative or when I get to be like highly detailed creative. It depends on the day. Because, oh my God, because let me tell you, I've had days when my workload did not match with my mental state, and those are
especially in a creative field when you're like, come on, brain, think of things, be creative. It's 4 o'clock. I need to finish in an hour and a half.
I do like, though, sometimes when you don't have to be in one track, when you can shift tracks, because sometimes that allows, if you feel the momentum on the mechanic side petering out, you can go back onto the more lore development side and pick the momentum up and switch back and forth. Mm-hmm. That can be fun to keep the focus and the energy going. But yeah, it's really hard to grind out the lore chapters when all you want to do is make a bunch of monsters.
Monsters of Drakenheim, as I said, it's hitting Kickstarter on the 20th. So I'm getting my date right in front of me. I'm
going to do that again. 26th of March.
Thank you, Monty.
Can we follow this Kickstarter right now?
Yeah. You can follow it right now. There's a link. It'll be, I'm going to guess, actually, I have no idea what order. I'm going to guess, Kelly, if you point directly upwards, a link on YouTube will be appearing right there that you can follow now to get to the pre-launch page, or I've put it in the Twitch chat. It'll be down in the description. It'll be places. It'll be all over the shop. If you sign up for the VIP Discord as well, which you can do ahead of the campaign, you unlock a free set of resin dice when you pledge. That'll just come free with the rest of your pledge.
They have eyes in them. they got eyeballs in them. Sick. Yeah.
And you also get access to behind the scenes content. People in the Discord saw the cinematic trailer ahead of time. And speaking of which, go check out the cinematic trailer. It is actually sick.
The Chris Cox Tech News.
Chris Cox has been quoted. Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro, for those that aren't aware, has been quoted in an interview on VentureBeat as saying, like, maybe AI is cool, actually. Now, I'm going to immediately retcon a little bit of what I said, because I think that the way this was reported by gaming websites was a little bit different from what he actually said, if you go and read the actual interview on VentureBeat. Basically, he said that Hasbro has been performing AI R&D in the background for a while now. They experimented with, and I don't think this was a secret to anybody, but like Trivial Pursuit Infinite, I think it was called, which was an infinite generating questions for Trivial Pursuit as an AI program, which I think was free to access, but it saw sales of Trivial Pursuit rise as a result of deploying that. And that the company, you know, it's a 100-year-old company. It's got 50 years of D&D as of this year with thousands of adventures. Magic the Gathering has been around for 35 years. Peppa Pig has been around for 20 years. Who knew? Transformers has been around since the 80s. Yeah, they might build something that, you know, potentially draws on. The way that he talked about it wasn't so much, to my impression of the interview, we're going to write a D&D adventure using AI. The impression I got was that they want to create, and I don't know whether this makes it better or not, but just for the sake of accuracy, was that they wanted to lean into user creator tools that would use AI using the content that Hasbro owns currently, because they have, you know, 50 years of D&D to draw on that Wizards of the Coast in theory owns the IP rights to. So what I'm imagining, and this is not what Chris Cox said, but this is just theoretical, portrait maker on D&D Beyond that allows you to create your own character using a large language model that is drawing, or a visual model that is drawing on the art that Wizards has created or commissioned over the last couple of years. Yeah, the indication to me was that, you know, they still want to be careful about how they go about it. They want to respect the rights of their artists. They want to respect the rights of their creators. But they are definitely experimenting with AI in ways that could create user creation tools.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And I got to say, I'm still against it. There's a lot of tools out there that my D&D group uses just for fun, basically every week to make character portraits. None of us are professional level artists, though several of us, you know, like to draw for fun. But all of us, when we see a new pic crew show up, or, you know, a 2D doll maker, essentially, to put together images of our characters, we have a great time figuring out how to use them and sharing the pictures we make with it. And those are made by artists who want to share, you know, their creativity in creating the different parts of these pic crews. This AI argument for me never comes down to the quality of the product, because it's either going to get really good, or in some cases it is already really good, but it always comes down to two things. One, the immediate respect of the artist's own copyright, right? Where is this training data coming from?
100%.
And second, it comes down to the longer term picture of, if we're soft launching AI generated stuff for users only, I hate to engage in what some might call fallacious thinking, but this truly does seem like a slippery slope to me, from AI art on the user side to AI art in published products. Intentionally, as opposed to unintentionally.
I want to be very specific in this, that I agree with James that I'm not a big fan of seeing AI specifically taking over what I would say are all the creative fields, because creativity to me is a very human expression, and it's a beautiful thing that humanity has going for it. I like the idea of AI being used as a tool for things like, I wish AI was doing my taxes. I actually don't mind the idea of the Trivial Pursuit game that you brought up, because AI being used to create endless Trivial Pursuit, I love trivia. If I had a way to click a button and be like, oh, more trivia always? Great. Cool use of AI. I admit that. But we're starting to see AI do things like create realistic videos and mimic people's voices. And that's getting to a point where there are useful ways to use this that are less problematic. But the problem is that in creating those, you're opening the floodgates to destroying a lot of what artists dedicate their lives to. And as somebody who is a writer, I don't know, I'm afraid of the day that they're like, yeah, AI wrote this D&D book. Like, what happens then with our passions and our projects? And I just think that it needs to be something that's carefully looked at as we move forward. Mm. And like, I don't know, I rewatched the movie Her again the other day, which is a great movie that was a little bit before its time, about artificial intelligence transcending humans in many ways. And I thought it was a very powerful statement on, like, if we teach AI too much, it's going to be able to do things better than us. And then where do we stand?
What's also, just very quickly, an interesting piece of speculative fiction, and this might sound silly, but is The Orville. I don't know if anybody's watched that. The first episode, it comes across like it's going to be a parody of Star Trek, and then it's actually like an amazing Star Trek kind of a love letter. But the character of, I think it's Isaac, is the like robot. If you watch that show imagining that Isaac is a large language model and not true intelligence necessarily, it kind of works still. And I don't think they wrote it with that in, you know, as the intention, but it is fascinating to watch that show and think of Isaac with that context in mind, in terms of philosophy of where AI is going.
I had the great privilege during my PhD studies to, before the current explosion of AI, work with several professors at the University of Toronto who were working with early forms of these large language models. And I attended several seminars on the impact of art and AI, and nobody thought this was what was going to happen. And this was in 2019. Right. There is a narrative that says that human brains work like computers, and therefore these AI are simply doing what the human brain does. And I want to simply remind everybody that we don't actually totally know how the human brain works. We don't really know how consciousness works. So to insist that a computer works like a human brain is a conclusion that is drawn based on incomplete information and a not full understanding of how consciousness and the mind behaves. So there are many people that come with this argument that says, well, a large language model is simply doing what a human artist does, just in a computerized form. And simply put, we do not know enough about how human brains work to actually make that conclusion. And so I think that these, for me, the biggest concern at this stage is, I'll echo what James says. It can't be using the copyright of other people. It seems to me to be something that is mulching up a bunch of different information together. And so I do think that as long as these large language models are respecting copyright in using the works that they source from, then we can have an interesting conversation about how they might be useful tools. And there's a whole conversation about the ethics that can be applied there. But I also want to say is that you know, for me in my thesis research, technology is a tool, and tools shape human understanding. There is no such thing as politically neutral technology, just as there's no such thing as politically neutral art. All machines, all technologies, they shape human understanding. They redefine our consciousness. My favorite saying is that when the tool in your hand is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so for me, the biggest concern is when the tool in your hand is a large language model. What is the hammer? Why is this thing smashing? If it's hammering in nails, it's fine. But are we trying to say that this thing that is really a hammer is some sort of mind? It's not.
That's what Chris Cox seemed to be suggesting, was that, you know, we've got so much, you know, within Hasbro to draw upon. The big question there is that how large language models work? My impression is, like, you need an internet-sized database, not just, like, your little corner of something. I don't know. Photoshop apparently draws from Adobe Image to create images, and, you know, people are split on how effective that is, but we shall see. The other thing Chris Cox said is wanting Hasbro to kind of, over the next couple of years, move further into becoming a video game publishing company. And they've already made steps towards that, not just with licensing out Baldur's Gate, obviously being the famous recent example. Game Loft Montreal have just announced that they're working on a D&D licensed video game, which will be a life simulator and an action RPG and a real-time survival game. So it's promising to make your coffee and tuck you into bed at night. It'll be interesting to see what that game is. But interestingly as well, James, do you remember when we were talking about Chains of Asmodeus last year and we went on this whole mystery tour about who James Olin was and why he was working for a video game company that was technically part of Wizards of the Coast and how he managed to publish Chains of Asmodeus and from within Wizards of the Coast, but it also wasn't from within Wizards of the Coast? Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. What was the name of that company again? I don't remember. Do you remember?
Archetype Entertainment.
Archetype. Yes. Yes, I remember us having a whole discussion about that. Did you find an answer?
Less than a month after we had that discussion, they announced at the Game Awards their first video game, which is called Exodus Become the Traveler, which looks like a Mass Effect-style sci-fi RPG. Archetype Entertainment is owned by Wizards of the Coast.
Yes, I remember us having a whole conversation about that too.
Yeah. I don't believe Exodus is a licensed thing. I think it's a new IP, but I think Chris Cox was talking about through their video game explorations of like figuring out ways to leverage existing IPs and then also creating new IPs. And Exodus appears to be a new IP that they're developing. And look, I don't judge video games based on cinematic trailers because I want to know what the game's like to play, but it looks cool. That looks like a space.
It's got an intelligent pig or something like that.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
I was mildly interested in it. I didn't know all of that, but I did see it floating around and it looked cool.
Who here has had a chance to even just glance at the Daggerheart playtest material?
Glanced at.
You know, Daggerheart recently came out with its playtest, its first public playtest packet. I had the good fortune to be a part of its private playtest, at least a little bit. I've seen two different consecutive iterations of its developing rules. I built a character in one and I played a session in another. Many of the things that I saw there were identical or at least very close to the way that it's appeared in this public playtest packet. But this was the first time I got to see the rule book as a whole. As you might see, if you look at the playtest packet, its character sheet is very effective at telling you everything you need to know to play a character. And that's the thing that I have to praise first about Daggerheart, because I have a mix of praise and critique here, but the thing that strikes me right out of the gate, as far as Daggerheart is concerned, is that it's a game with incredible UX UI. And that is something I am very hard on role-playing games about. Honestly, I think D&D's UX UI is often terrible. You need to kind of be familiar with the sometimes cryptic way D&D presents its information. But Daggerheart has a really lovely combination of colors and symbols, and it's much lauded already sidecar to the character sheet that you can slide to either side to point directly at what you need to do. If you look at the character sheet, you will see that its class-specific character sheets have everything you need to level up within its three various tiers of play. The character sheet itself, in many ways, is enough to play the game with. You should still have the cards, the domain cards, and you should still have your pair of dice, your 2d12, that I'll talk about in a moment as well. But it's a really very self-contained game, especially if you compare it to, say, 5th edition D&D, which often, which has a fairly pretty character sheet, but, within instance, I find myself running out of space to do what I need to do it with. From level one, if I'm a spellcaster, and from level three onwards, if I'm literally anyone else.
Just the way that they're providing the cards on sheets that you can then just cut out. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. That makes it so simple. So you can still use those card character sheet mechanics and access those digitally by printing them out and then cutting them up if you want to use them that way. Or it's also on Demiplane. There's a character creator on Demiplane if you want to go entirely digital.
I was lucky enough as a member of their closed playtesting to get a copy of the playtest materials they deployed at Gen Con last year. So this is, it's quite out of date, but it...
There we go. Yeah, right, hold here, it right there, hold it there. All right, great. Now I can screen cap that for later.
Can I do a YouTube face at it? Can I be like...
I had to mock that up 2 weeks ago, but yes, thank you for now providing a native one.
And so, you can see right from the start that its informational design is all very, very tight. You can see that its classes are very interestingly represented. Let me see if I can find one that does it like this. Here's its druid class. You can see it right there on the card here. Will it focus? Yeah. Each class has two subclasses in the book, and you can see that, a double-sided card with both subclasses on it. Very smart. Each one of these classes is tied to one of, I believe it's 9 domains, which are kind of like spell schools, kind of like power sources, if you're a 4th edition head. Of those 9 domains, they have 1st through 10th leveled powers. And guess what? As the max level in Daggerheart is 10, so when you reach 10th level, you have access to your 10th level domain powers. Simple as. There are 9 domains, and every class has access to 2 of them, which makes this nice little synergy where you find yourself either filling roles in the party, using some of these domain powers that other members of your party don't have, or maybe engaging in a little bit of extra sort of domain, intra-domain synergy, where, not everyone's going to have all their powers. I've got a limited amount of powers. I think it's you can only have 5 kind of in your loadout at a time with any others that gained through level up kind of on a sideboard. But if you've got a friend who has a cohesive domain power with you, because your classes have a little bit of overlap, then all of a sudden you've got some teamwork going on. And I found in play that paired really well with its somewhat looser initiative system, where essentially players will just, they'll do an action and they'll put a little token, some kind of gribbly, onto an action tracker in the middle of the table. And that'll just keep going. Player A might do that. And player A might say, hey, I've actually got something really good to follow that up with. Does anyone else have anything really good? And they're like, no, go for it. We'll do something else and put another token on there. Or then player B will instantly follow up and go, bah-bah. Or the GM will intrude and spend the action tokens that the players have given them on the action tracker to start doing stuff in the middle of things. Initiative has caught a lot of flack in early pre-play playtesting. And I was surprised by how functional it is.
I don't know. Maybe having played a lot of like Blaze in the Dark and Powered by the Apocalypse, which doesn't really have initiative either. Like, and I feel increasingly like I'm more of a turn-taking style of like, just my GMing style has always been check in with everyone around the table, then do my thing as a GM. So like, I've increasingly felt like I need initiative, like a hard initiative system less and less.
I think you could probably even hack that into that system without too much issue, because there was a rhythm that my playtest group fell into that we occasionally shocked ourselves out of, where it was, all right, well, let's each one of us put down one action token, and then we'll remove them and start again. Or we wouldn't remove them, but the GM would intrude every now and then to spend the tokens. But we basically would never double up on a turn within a round, so to speak.
I think I'm actually a little different from Monty in that regard, that like for me, that was the thing I saw criticized a lot. And so I read the rules for how initiative was working and how like taking your turns in combat. And I actually found that it was quite intuitive, and I felt like it actually digs down to the core of what tabletop role-playing games are, which is narrative shared storytelling. And so when we talk about it as a narrative shared storytelling, there's not really any problem with sitting around a table narratively telling a story and taking turns doing it. Initiative in other games has helped with making sure that everybody is getting a turn, but and maybe Daggerheart's harder for newcomers. I'm not sure. I'm not a newcomer. But having played a lot of different TTRPGs, I looked at the system. I read that section and was like, yeah, cool. Me and my improv-reliant friends could all sit around and rock this, because we can just like bounce off of one person after another telling the story.
I just want to jump in here because I'm fascinated by this system as well. Just to quickly explain for anybody who hasn't seen it before, and correct me if my understanding of this is wrong, but basically when a combat starts, you know, it really is just organic. It's just like, all right, I pull out my weapon and I attack this person, and the game master will say, okay, well, we're in combat now, but put a token on the action card and roll to see if you hit this person.
Mm-hmm.
And the players, every time a player takes a turn, which is typically, to translate into 5e a little bit, is like an action, and they can move kind of wherever they want within their movement distance. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to the next player. So there's no bonus action, special, reaction that I've seen so far. I haven't looked at all the powers or the kind of domain abilities yet, so I could be slightly wrong there. But at its base level, everybody takes an action, puts down a token, then the next person takes an action, puts down a token. And if I'm reading this correctly, this can hypothetically just go on forever, because when it swaps back to the GM is when somebody either succeeds with fear, where their fear dice is the highest, or fails in whatever role they're attempting to do. And the GM can also, if they wish to, spend 2 fear points that they have to intercede, but that doesn't end the player's turn. They're spending 2 fear points to activate 1 monster. So the GM has to have enough fear points to be able to spend to intercede. Now, when I think at first blush, this seems like, oh, well, the players could go on forever and the monsters never get a turn. And I think, like, in theory, yes, but I would like to think that they've tuned the game well enough that they know succeeding with fear is likely enough to come up frequently enough that it's not going to feel like the players are going on endlessly. And that when they do, it feels like this cool confluence of events of, you know, the dice are just in our favor at the moment. Let's steamroll these dudes. And I quite like it because it doesn't have this Pokemon battle, diddly, 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 everybody roll for initiative. It's time for combat kind of thing. It's meant to move smoothly into combat and then smoothly out of combat, because the game's not changing between the start and end of combat. My concern with it, I quite like it, for the record. I am keen to try it. My concern with it is kind of similar to the concern that I had at with the MCDM game and the experience that we had at conventions using that sort of free-form popcorn initiative is when you're playing with friends, great. When you're not playing with friends and you've just got some dude at the table going like, no, but I can do something again, but I can do something again, you know, and everybody's being too polite and they don't want to intercede. I'm not sure how this freeform style of initiative works at conventions or if there's some guidance for GMs on how to run it for groups that aren't acquainted.
I think you stumbled upon something incredibly salient here, Ben, and it kind of draws us to look at the origin of role-playing games, right? How did D&D get involved? D&D was created through tournament-style convention wargaming, right? D&D's big moments were when things like Tomb of Horrors, Lost Caverns of Sojkanth were being played at Gen Con with a bunch of, you know, friends often, but also random con-goers. And that's the legacy that D&D has carried forward with it into things like Organized Play Adventurers League, and stuff like that. Whereas how did Critical Role come about? It's a group of friends playing a game together. And so that's the tenor of the interactions that are being, you know, that are the core audience, so to speak, of Daggerheart. I agree. I think that's the greatest point of weakness of this initiative system is that it's incredibly easy for someone to be to be a jerk.
It's all right. We get one per episode.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a PG-13 rating.
As long as it's not in the first 15 seconds.
Yeah. Well, it's super easy for someone to be a jerk in a system that doesn't intentionally create these guides there. And I always think back to something that one of the creators of 5th edition said very early on is, we don't make rules that assume you're a jerk. And they said that, but there was so much legacy of D&D creating rules, assuming people were jerks behind it, that they might not have been doing it intentionally, but they were perpetuating these anti-jerk protections. And initiative is an anti-jerk protection. To remove classic turn-style initiative, it does put some faith in the GM to actually be a trusted referee and for the players to put their trust in the referee.
From my years of playing both heavily in conventions and heavily at in organized play, that trust between the players and the game master is so important. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that trust, there's no number of rules are going to save you.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think, you know, I made this analogy before and I'll continue to make it because I think it's personally apt, but you know, in the, with the dragon slayers that are emerging as have become known on social media, the games that are going to become competitors for D&D 5th edition. It feels to me that, you know, the MCDM role-playing game is going to be the tactical epic feeling in its tactics, more rigid, kind of wargamey feel to it. I've been rebuffed on that description of the MCDM game before, but that's just my sense of how it plays is very like this ability procs that ability procs that ability, you know, kind of almost like playing a Magic the Gathering or something. Daggerheart kind of being the much more open. I'm not going to go and say it's rules light, James, but it's definitely rules open where there's a lot more room for invention within it. And then 5e feels like it's kind of sitting between those two where it's like, yeah, there's, you know, a rigid set of rules here. This is how you grapple someone in combat or whatever. You know, Daggerheart might have grapple mechanics. I'm not sure. But there's not an answer to everything necessarily for people to have to arbitrate at the table. I'm in the chat from J Pizza Beat saying, maybe when the GM clears the counters off the action tracker, instead of returning them to the players, the counters sit in a gated spot. And the counters only go back at a rate governed by something else to avoid action hogging. I believe, J Pizza Beats, if I've read initiative correctly, there's no limit to how many, like players don't spend tokens. They simply put a token on the action card for GMs to spend those tokens later. That's but there's right. no limit to how many tokens a player can put onto the action sheet.
My big interaction so far with Daggerheart was looking at the initiative system because that's what fascinated me the most. I love free-flowing games, and I think I do hear you guys, though, that most of my experience in all TTRPGs is playing with a group of my close friends. And most of the tables that I played at are a group of people who I trust very much, who are all invested in storytelling. And that's probably why when I read it, I was like, I see no problem here, because I was seeing a system that I could throw down with my friends and have a really interesting narrative element take place. But the moment that you brought up play at a convention with a group of strangers, I have sat at a few tables of people that I did not know, where one person at that table steamrolled the entire decision-making of the whole group, or, you know, another table where I wasn't allowed to make the choices I wanted to make because somebody else wanted to make them for me, or like weird interactions like that at bad TTRPG tables. And if I was ever in a situation like that where I didn't have the rules to help me have my moments, then I might get left in the dust, because I'm usually a pretty polite person when I play especially with strangers. I'm usually like, is everybody having a good time? Oh, I will expend my good time to make sure other people are. And in a game where somebody else who's bolder and braver than me can steamroll that, it might be bad for the more shy players who are willing to get steamrolled in the process.
It's very important to have a DM who's looking out for shyer players in a system like this. I agree.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the duality dice real quick, the core dice rolling mechanic, which is 2d12 that are distinct from each other, often by different color, is suggested in the rules. And this system touches upon a lot of other core systems. So it might be difficult to talk about it all in this time slot, basically. But one of these D12s is the hope die, and one of these D12s is the fear die. And you roll them together and you look at their combined result to determine the numerical result of your check or of the action you're taking. And often, like in D&D, there is a target number that you're trying to beat with the overall result of your combined dice. But the die which has the higher individual number has an effect. The first effect that this playtest talks about is it generates resources called hope and fear. Fear goes straight to the DM's pocket, which they can spend to do stuff. Typically, spending fear lets them take a turn, but it lets them do other stuff too, if my understanding is correct. And hope is marked right there on your character sheet, and it lets you do extra stuff. Like, for instance, you can spend it. I'm looking at the cards in front of me, trying to find one. Your class often has spend hope to do something. But that is not the most interesting part of it to me. That stuff is fun. I like it. I like marking little resources just from rolling. It's fun. But more importantly is it creates a 2x2 grid that reminds me of the Fantasy Flight Star Wars dice system, sans obtuse symbols. Where in that system, you can have a success with consequence. Well, let's just roll it out. Let's just talk it out here. Success with hope. You succeed at what you do and things turn out really well for you. Perfect success. Success with fear. You succeed at what you're trying to do. There's a complication that is determined by conversation between you and the DM is I believe it what it is. I don't think the GM might just say, here's the complication, but I do think there's some shared storytelling that happens. Failure with hope means that you fail, but there's some hope in the situation, again, determined in conversation, or there's failure with fear, and really this just could not have turned out worse for you. And I love that binary breaking mechanic. That's often my biggest criticism with D&D, is that it is too locked into a binary mode of success or failure.
Totally agree.
This feels very natural, and in play, it felt very natural too. I was playing with some very good storytellers there, and a GM who is very open to yes-anding us, which I kind of think is the spirit in which this game is meant to be played. And so with that spirit in mind, it creates a really collaborative and dynamic experience at the table that I liked a lot.
I want to jump right in there and talk about, I'm known on my channel for having ran several episodes of Monster of the Week, and that's known as a rules light system with degrees of success. Not quite the hope fear system, but it does run on a system that uses, if you roll on 2d6 plus your whatever ability is implied by your action that you're taking. If you roll a 12 or higher, it's a absolute success. You do what you set out to do. If it's something like an 8 or higher, you get to pick the thing that you do from a list. If it's like a 5, 6, or 7. I might be getting these numbers wrong, but it's success at a cost. And that's where it actually does imply. It says like you negotiate what the cost is with the DM. So as the DM, I get to make up, like, you know, if somebody's trying to jump out a window, it's like your foot gets stuck. You can either lose your shoe or, like, you know, whatever, something that puts them in a situation. And then if it's below a certain number, then it's an absolute failure. And so I love degrees of success, because it really lets you play with narrative elements while also rolling dice. It lets you have a negotiation between the player and the DM most of the time. And this is actually, I think, one of the coolest parts of a system like that is the average die roll actually lands in the success at a cost category, which to me is the most interesting category. And so those negotiations that happen at the table of you can do what you're going to set out to do, but here's what it's going to cost you, is really what ends up pushing the narrative. And then it makes it more exciting when the players get to do what they set out to do in a grand scale or fail miserably. And so knowing that that system is in Daggerheart there in some capacity, that's my favorite system of player DM negotiation that happens in a TTRPG, and something that I've always been sad D&D doesn't have.
I'll just express my bias. And so James, does this mean that all four outcomes are roughly equally possible?
No, they are not. It does depend on the DC, to borrow D&D terms, right? Of, you know, which is it because we're looking at the total of the two dice to determine overall success or failure. And then it's the higher one, hope or fear, which determines its secondary outcome. So let's say I'm attempting to, you know, climb a cliff that's slippery in the rain, right? And so it's got a target number of 14. I'm rolling my 2d12. The hope die gets a 12. The fear die gets a 3. That's a 15. And hope is the higher die. So that's a 15 with hope against a target number of 14. That's a success with hope.
So that means that with either success or failure, it's 50-50 whether you're succeeding with hope or fear.
Yes. Now, if both dice are identical, if you roll doubles, that's a critical success, regardless of overall anything. No hope or fear is generated. Mm. That's just a success. I could roll snake eyes. That's a critical success.
I'll just express my slight bias towards systems that favor the success at a cost result. Mm. I think success at a cost is narratively the most interesting. I think it's the pulpiest one because that's the one that is moving the story forward while also creating, like, building tension. Although it's tied with failure with a,
it's the yes, but, or the no, and.
Yeah. The yes, but, the no, and are my favorites, right? Yeah.
So the system definitely favors success, and success at a cost or success purely is 50-50.
Okay.
At least that's as far as I'm aware. There might be some more obscure mechanics in the playtest document that I didn't encounter that could bias the individual dice. But as far as I've seen, there's nothing there.
I'm looking forward to the YouTube comments.
Are they just using hope and fear as, like, mechanical shorthand, or is the implication that fear and hope are supposed to be thematic ideas that are being engaged with on every single roll?
I think the names are intended to be vague and evocative.
Okay.
They aren't necessarily supposed to be literally hope and literally fear, but one might feel particular hope even if they fail, and one might feel some fear even if they succeed, depending on that. But it's broader. It's broader than all that.
Okay. I'm getting that scene from Donnie Darko. Different different movies, but I was getting Donnie Darko with, like, you can't just group everything into these two emotions.
M5 tie-in commented something that I kind of agree with. I'm going to have to see it in play to see how much this exercises my brain. You know, is it harder for new game masters? This feels like a system that needs a good game master for a good experience, because, you know, succeeding with hope or succeeding with fear requires the game master to come up with a little something extra that happens or doesn't happen as a result of the non-binary dice roll. And, like, on every single roll, if you're rolling, you know, 20 attacks over the course of a combat And it's like, yeah, I hit him. And it's like, all right, but you twist your ankle. Ah, shattered. I do like the system does introduce mechanical kind of benefits or drawbacks. So if you succeed with fear, it does say the GM gets a fear token. So maybe they don't have to come up with something narrative every time. And yet there's still consequences there. But I had a similar thought, M5.
My first statement here might sound a little mildly arrogant, but I don't mean it that way. I'm either a really good GM, or it actually comes more naturally than you would think. When I was running Monster of the Week, I was nervous about my improv skills. The reason why I did it on the show is because we did a play test of Monster of the Week before I ever ran it on the show. And I was nervous because I'm like, this leaves a lot up to me to make up as I go along. And when the moments happened where I had to give like a cost, it almost always felt like there was something narratively that just made sense in the moment. Somebody's foot getting stuck, somebody dropping their weapon, right. Somebody tripping, yeah. Somebody letting go of somebody else's hand. Like there was always something that just in the moment, as soon as it came up, I was like, okay, you can do this. I've only gotten snagged, I think, two or three times during the show. And when I did, I simply, as the game master, was just like, all right, there's going to be a cost involved. Let's think what that is. And actually, there were times where my player's like, ooh, what if I drop my flashlight? I'm like, yeah, sure, cool.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. It's like, you can help because failing is kind of fun sometimes. So to be like, what if I drop my flashlight? And you as the game master are just like, yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so you can do this, but you're going to drop your flashlight. Do you still want to go? And like, so those things actually happen more naturally. And you're invited to, if you are struggling, open the conversation, I'd say, to the table and be like, okay, we need a cost. What's awesome? And even another player might be like, oh, throw them out the window. And you're like, yes. It's more fluid at the table than you might think. And I would say the joy is in trying it. You'd be surprised how good you can do when I was nervous about a system like this, but then I tried it and I was like, wow, that was fun.
Well, speaking of fun things, this podcast has been a lot of fun. And much like Daggerheart's role-playing initiative system, we haven't had much structure here because we are well over time. So I am going to call it there. This is the end of the podcast. Thanks for everybody watching on Twitch. I really appreciate if you want to follow the channel, we're almost at 1,000 followers on the Twitch channel. So the button, it'll be
good job. There
maybe if you're watching, I'm not sure. Monty and Kelly, where can folks find you on the internet?
youtube.com/dungeondudes or just plug us into your favorite social and you'll find us. We're reasonably active on all the platforms, but the YouTube channel is where all the magic happens.
Nice. Monsters of Drakenheim again on the 26th. It is launching. I'm going to throw a link up right now. I'm just being handed something from off screen. Is this from the... Oh, it's the dice bag from Monsters.
Oh, the Bruce of Holding.
Man, they do have eyes in them.
This is my first time seeing this.
Too. Let me grab the D20.
Those are so cool.
I had this trouble when we did a painting stream. Get that 20 on there.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
I don't know if you can see, but the eye moves around inside.
I love those sharp edge dice are my favorite. So I'm so glad that we're doing a couple sets like these.
Yeah, this thing looks like it's made of glass. It's super cool. Let me just...
Yeah.
Okay,
they're going to have to send me a couple sets of those because those might be my new, GM dice. I need with any set of dice, I need four sets. That's my rule.
I need four Bruce bags. Is what I need.
I agree. I also have four sets when I'm GMing. All right. Well, that being the last little treat of the episode, I've been Ben Byrne here with Monty Martin, Kelly McLaughlin, James Hake. Comment, subscribe, stars, thumbs, all those things are great. Helps us stay on the air. And we will see you next week with another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.